better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Hi, folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life. If times get tougher, even if they don't. Today is November the 4th, 2013, and this is episode 1240 of the Survival Podcast. Today we are going to have a Monday show, an actual Monday show, the way Monday shows have traditionally been. And we're kind of back to our regularly scheduled programming where we have a Monday listener feedback show where you send me emails. We have a Tuesday standalone show. We have a couple interviews. And we have a Friday call-in show on Friday. So we're pretty much back to that. There may be a little hiccup with that because tomorrow I have to go to the Mint. Remember, Mulligan Mint is running an open house. I think it runs from 3 p.m. till 9 p.m. tomorrow. If you're in the Dallas-Fort Worth area or if you can make the drive from somewhere not too crazily far away, you might want to come on by. I'll be speaking along with some other folks, and you get a tour of the Mint, see the minting process. It should be quite interesting. You have to say one thing for Rob Gray, despite all his troubles, he's being pretty open when you're willing to open the doors of a Mint and let the public come in. That says something about the transparency that you're operating under, even under the toughest circumstances. If you are in the area and would like to support Mulligan Mint, I'd also like to point out those of you that are somewhat local, that want to do business but are afraid to order given the current situation, I understand. They will be doing business at the Mint tomorrow. You can buy and walk out with your product when you do. So that would be one way that you could help, and I'd love to meet many of you. So come on by if you get a chance. Full details are on the Mint's website. I did a post about it last week. I'll do a quick little update post about it today. Before I get into your feedback, this is a show, of course, on a Monday where you send me your emails. You send me an email. You send it to jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. Or in some parts of the country, I guess you'd say jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. And you put question for Jack, comment for Jack, subject for Jack, whatever. Movie for Jack, video for Jack, article for Jack, whatever, the subject line. Key is three words and the second two being for Jack. And then make your point quick in that email. The quicker you make it, the more succinct you are. And if you're sending me a link, you know, send me a sentence. This link's about blah, 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 and this is why I thought you'd like it. Quick. You're more likely to get through the screening process and end up on a show like this. The volume of the emails is very, very high. So if you send me an email and don't hear anything back, it's probably a volume thing, not that your idea wasn't good or your thought wasn't good or your question wasn't good. I can just only do so much. Before I get to that feedback, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsor. Sponsor of the day, number one today, bulkammo.com. You need ammo, and you need it in bulk. We're going to talk today about another reason that ammunition may continue to remain in short supply for quite some time to come. It's an issue that's not as bad as some are making it, but it sure as heck ain't good. In any event, if you want to have ammo on hand, the best way to do it is to make sure that you're buying it for the best price you can get it in the calibers that you need and in large quantities at one time. Best place I know to do that online anyway. bulkammo.com. Next up today, Safe Castle Royal, the original Survival Podcast sponsor, the sponsor that will have their fifth year anniversary with us in January. 5 years they've stood at our side as our sponsor. So give them some business the next time you get a chance. If you need something for your prepping, you'll probably find it at Safe Castle. You want to save even more money, get this. They have a discount buyers program. People buy it every day, $49, and you get lifetime discounts from Safe Castle. Great deal. You want it for free? Okay, become a member of my support brigade, and Vic over there will give it to you for free. So basically, your first year of MSB will then effectively cost you $1. That's just one MSB benefit. The bigger issue, though, is it shows the support commitment that Vic has made to the Survival Podcast. He's been doing that almost since he became a sponsor. I think we were about a month into his sponsorship where we came to that agreement. He's given away thousands of free memberships valued at $49 a piece to this audience in supporting the show. Think of that the next time you're about to buy something from Amazon or something like that. See if one of our sponsors, a family-owned business like Safe Castle Royal, who gives you a discount because you're a member of this community and supports what we do here, has it for you or has a product maybe that costs a little more but's even better. One thing about Safe Castle and Bulk Ammo and all of our sponsors, let's say you're not sure what you need. All of them are people you can contact that will help you make a decision as well. Check them out today, bulkammo.com and Safe Castle Royal. Best way to find them is go to the Survival Podcast, click on their banners in the right-hand margin, and you know you're dealing with my official sponsors. With that, want to remind you guys again about that Member Support Brigade. It is a great deal. It flat out is. The discounts alone pay for it over and over again. I got an email yesterday. A guy said he added up his savings, and that this year he saved over $300 using MSB discounts. Now, he's obviously buying quite a bit of stuff, but at a $50 membership, that is a 6-to-1 return. That's a pretty good investment. And it's also a way to support the show. Some folks don't really focus on the discounts and the extra content and the weekend review videos and everything else. They just say, hey, I want to support the show. I think it's worth 20 cents an episode. That's about what it comes out to if you support the show at $50 a year. So please consider joining. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on members or the Member Support Brigade banner for more information. Military, law enforcement, Peace Corps, active duty or prior service, and first responders like EMTs, paramedics, and firefighters. All of you guys qualify for a service discount. Just email me with service discount in the subject line, and in one or two sentences, no more, one or two sentences, tell me who you are and what you're doing, or if you're prior service, what you did, and I will send you back a discount code to thank you for your service. You need to do this before, not after you join the brigade, or if you're already a member and you didn't take advantage of it, you cancel your renewal if you're doing automatic renewal, or just wait to expire if otherwise. And then when you renew, make sure you email me before you renew, and we'll get it for you on your renewal. Okay, with that, let's go ahead and get into the main topic of our show today. The first two things I'm going to cover, I'm not going to talk about who sent it to me because the answer is everybody. And I don't know that that's really true. I hate, you know what? I get a little pet peeve for you from Jack. I hate in a commercial where they're like, everybody is doing X, or everybody's listening to, or in the news where they say, everybody's talking about, because usually I'm not, and I'm part of everybody. So, it's not right for me to say everybody sent this to me. It feels that way. Dozens and dozens of people sent me one of these stories and probably a couple hundred the other. Let's start out the one that I've been getting for weeks now, and then the hundreds of emails from people, hysterical emails sometimes. The government is running exercises on the electrical grid, and they're planning to actually use these exercises as a black ops, false flag operation, and they're going to shut down the grid in November. I'm going to answer this with one sentence, and I want all of you that are buying into this crap to listen to me very, very carefully. I'll give you a multitude of reasons why it's true after I give you the statement. Here it is. No, they're not. Okay? Very, very simple. I would like all of you who are listening to people that are telling you this is going to happen to make a commitment to yourself and to me and the rest of this community right now that when we get to December 1st and they haven't done what they said they're going to do yet again with these people that constantly say they're going to do it this month and you know they're going to do it and you know who I'm talking about there, to be merciless, merciless, merciless in your emails and contacts with these people to say, it didn't happen, why didn't it happen? Don't tell me the next one that's not going to happen, that you're going to tell me is going to happen. Don't make excuses. I want to know how you got this wrong. And I'm going to tell you what they're going to say. Well, they were just floating it to see if how the response would be. This is stupid. Let me explain something to you guys about your government. Your government is not above manufacturing a crisis, okay? Your government likes to manufacture crises that it can control and keep a lid on. Shutting down the dadgon electrical grid from coast to coast, sea to shining sea, is not one that they can keep a frickin' lid on. Okay? It is a bunch of hype and nonsense used by people that want to sell you on fear. And you need to start using something we talked about last week. It's called critical thinking. Is there advantage to the government shutting down wholesale our electrical grid? And the answer is no. Just no. It will be devastating to the economy. But they're destroying the economy. Yeah, they are. But not really intentionally. I'll talk more about that in a second. The government likes crises that are actually small that they can make look large. They don't like actual big crises. Let me explain what I mean to you. The government likes, especially the people that want gun control, they like when one person shoots two or three other people with a gun. They like that. They really do. It gives them ammunition to say, hey, look, we got to do something about this. And, you know, just like what happened last week at LAX, no disrespect to anybody injured or killed or their family or friends thereof. But this guy shoots a couple people. A couple people get stepped on and trampled on running out the door. And it's a terrifying event. Oh, my God. Everybody's talking about it, right? Oh, it's on the news. And we have analysis from six different directions. Somebody gets freaking shot or killed every day in the ghetto and no one talks about it. Okay? You're more likely to get bit by a shark if you were swimming than get shot if you were at LAX on the day that it happened. It's nonsense. They like little crises that they can make look big because they can scare the shit out of everybody with it, but yet they don't lose any control. When the housing market fell apart and the stock market fell apart and they were freaking the hell out in 2008 and 2009, they may have capitalized on it, but they sure weren't happy about it because they were afraid they were going to lose control. And frankly, they were lucky that they got control back over the situation before it went too far. So the government doesn't plan to shut down the electrical grid. The government doesn't plan to crash the stock market. The government constantly engages in stupid shit that eventually result in these crises. And yes, when they happen, they try to take advantage of them. But even if you're a big believer in false flag operations, and I'm not one to tell you they don't happen, even in that case, they want to take something confined to an area and then make you convinced that it's vulnerable everywhere, all right? So they're not going to shut the freaking electrical grid down. And anybody saying this is not worthy of you paying attention to them anymore. They've clearly shown that they'll say or do anything to get you to listen to them, regardless of whether or not it's beneficial to you. And if that upsets anybody, I'm sorry. They're not going to do this. The person that's telling you they're going to do it has either bought into the bullshit and been misled, or they're purposely manipulating the data. So either you have a credibility issue with the person's capability and their knowledge and ability to disseminate information, and if that person comes out on December 1st and says, you know what, I got this one wrong, and I'm going to reevaluate the way I vet information, that person's probably great to listen to. If they make excuses or pretend it never happened and just go on to the next thing, stop listening to them. They're not worthy of your time. I mean, that's as blunt as I can be with this. Now, on false flag operations, this is the big one that's going around now. What they're saying is things like this. Well, you know, on the London bombings of the tubes, the train tubes, they were actually running a drill that simulated that when that happened. But do you know what? Let me tell you something about that. No one knew those drills were being run. Not publicly. They weren't talking about it. If you're going to run a false flag, then you're going to run drills that are the same as the false flag. The reason you do that is because a conspiracy has to be small. All right? I'm not saying they did. I'm saying if you do it, if you're the government and you're like, this would be a great idea. Okay? We're going to run this simulated attack, and we're going to run a false flag of the same attack at the same time. Why do you do that? Why do you do that? They say that we were running drills about planes being flown into buildings on 9/11. I believe we were. I believe it's public record, and we know that now. But you know who knew publicly that we were running those drills? Let's say in August of 2011? No one. You know who was talking about it? No one. If you're going to run a false flag commensurate with drills, you don't do it to advertise it. You do it to confuse your own people because you can't involve the entire, you know, NORAD in your conspiracy. You can't involve all the responders in your conspiracy. If you did this to run a false flag, you would be very quiet about the fact that the drills were going on. Very, very quiet. So that the public didn't know that that's what you were doing. So when you look at there's three places where this seems to have occurred. And I know some of you, this is going on a limb to accept it, but we have confirmation this is the case. That it was done in Spain with the bombings in Spain. It was done in London with the bombing of the subways, the tubes as they call them over there. And it was done 9/11 here. That there were actual drills being run of the same scenarios of the attack. There's only two ways you can interpret this. Okay? If it was one of them, you'd say it could be dumb luck. All right? But it's not. It was three. So either there were security leaks, intentional or otherwise, that tipped off the people doing the attacks that this would be a good time, or it was done on purpose. That's the only two conclusions a rational mind can draw. The fact that this happened by random happenstance three times in three major global terrorist attacks is ridiculous. You have better odds of winning the lottery twice with tickets you found on the ground than those three events of that magnitude just by happenstance happening. If you want to, you know, not let go of the government really does want to help us, then your only way that this occurred is that there's people in government who are, let's call them double agents, working with these terrorists, right? You have that, or you have the government actually running these things. But in all of those events, you don't advertise that this is what you're going to do. You hide it. If you were, again, one more time, just using your critical thinking and basic strategy and understanding of psychology, the reason you would do this would be to confuse your own people if you were doing it intentionally. So you wouldn't make these massive announcements that this was going to happen. What we found in Spain, London, and New York City is that these drills were found out about after the event, not before. So just use your brain and ask yourself, is there an advantage to doing this while this is going on? And the answer is no. Now, if I were an evil, tyrannical government that was looking to further oppress the American people and make them give up more of their liberty and safety, and I wanted to use some bullshit around the electrical grid's vulnerability, might I do something like a false flag on the grid to scare the shit out of people and get them to go along with it? Yes. How would I do this? I would not do it. I would not do it during a bunch of drills about it that are publicly known about and being talked about all over the place. If they did now, it would literally be confirmation that every tin hatter in the world was right, and even some of the dumbest sheeple would go, oh, gee, look what they did. Okay? So you wouldn't do it now. You would do it at a point where you'd already run the hype, and it all went over, and everybody looked at it and went, oh, they're going to do it. Oh, they didn't do it? Okay. And they forgot about it. And 6 months, a year or two later, you would do it in one major metropolitan area, and you would blame some scary terrorist or scary foreign nation and say they did it and say, look at this vulnerability. Now it's happened. That's how you would do it. So if it happens that way, and you want to make the case to me that they did it themselves, I'm probably going to be pretty open to that case. Now, if it doesn't pan out, then it doesn't pan out. But I'm going to be open to it. But the fact that your government is so stupid that they would do this with every eye on the ball while they did it is ridiculous. And again, I'm going to ask you, people that are listening to people that are telling you this is going to happen. They're saying it. They're not saying it's going to might happen or it's probably. They're saying it's going to happen. All of them are running their mouths about it. You hammer them on December 1st. Hammer them. And sadly, most of you that are mad at me for saying they're full of shit won't. When it doesn't happen, you'll buy into they were just floating it. Those of you who feel that way, you're not yet ready to start thinking critically, and I probably can't help you. But no, your government's not going to shut off the entire damn grid during drills about the grid being shut down. Just like I told you they weren't going to do a manufactured crisis in October. Did any of you ask the people that said that was going to happen why it didn't happen? Please do if you haven't. Oh, that's right. They went right onto this, so you would stop. You wouldn't ask that. Oh, it's all part of the same thing, right? Okay, yeah. It could be December. Maybe it'll do it in January, and then it'll be something new. Stop listening to these people, please. On that note, I have a supporter of the Member Support Brigade called Alerts USA. I've been receiving their alerts in their thread journal now for about a year, and I have a pretty substantial discount for you guys for them. I'm starting to feel very much like they're nothing but a bunch of hype-filled individuals. That I got an alert this weekend that they were going to remove fuel from the Fukushima reactor number 5, and it was a major catastrophic threat. Okay, what they're doing is exactly what they said they would be doing. Okay, it's actually good news. It means they've got enough control to be able to start removing this material that poses a threat, and that they've got control of that situation, at least on that reactor. When they say we're taking the radioactive fuel out and disposing of it, that's good. That's not a catastrophic threat to the United States. But maybe some of you don't feel that. Here's what I want to know. I want to hear from people in the comments, not by email. In the comments of today's episode, again, episode 1240 today, do you want me to retain Alerts USA as a discount vendor for the MSB, or would you like me to tell them to go pound sand? I'm putting this out to the community. I'll do whatever you guys say. Whatever the preponderance of evidence is from the community, As to the value of these people as a sponsor of the MSB, I will yield to the community. Even though my gut right now is to just throw them out. Because I think they're full of it. But if you're on the service and you're getting it, or you've checked into Thread Journal, if you like the information they're putting out, I'll leave it there. It's up to you. So you guys tell me. The next story. This one actually has some legs because it's true. And it's not good. Probably got several dozen about this, at least this last weekend. The last lead smelter in the U.S. is being closed. And, you know, what do you do with lead? You do lots of things. Probably the two biggest applications for lead right now are car batteries, lead acid storage batteries, and ammunition, right? Ammunition. So we're in a situation where we're going to no longer be smelting lead anywhere in the United States. Now, smelting lead is a really nasty process. It does result in a lot of pollution, and that's the grounds being used to shut it down. There's a lot of people saying it's being done specifically just to get rid of ammo, and I don't think so. But I will tell you this. The policymakers behind shutting it down certainly don't have any concerns about the additional bump in the road it puts with ammunition supplies. I'm sure that they see it as a very, very happy byproduct. But I think what you need to understand about these environmental weenies is they really believe in what they're doing environmentally. They believe it's necessary. All the good and the bad that they're doing. And I can't tell you that it's like really swell to be smelting lead. But I will tell you that when I hear there'll be no ammo left anymore, the first thing I do is look at the commodity in question, lead, and say, with this recent news, has lead gone way up in price? You would think if there was a big threat to the supply of lead, it would go up in price. And over the last 24 hours, it's gone down. Over the last 30 days leading up to this, it's gone up a little bit. From 92 cents a pound to just under a dollar a pound. Okay. 60-day lead spot is, it's up, but not very much. It's from like 97 cents a pound to 99 cents a pound on a moving average. Six-month lead, if I looked 6 months back, it actually was more expensive in 10 June. It's been higher than it is right now. It was higher than it is right now about 15 August. So it's not even the highest it's been in the last 6 months. It's nowhere near as close to as high as it's been in the last year. And the five-year price, we are kind of sitting on a multi-year floor about where the price of lead is right now. And in all of this time, if I go back to 2009, lead has bounced between $1 to $1.30 down to about 80 cents. So there's no big movement in lead. Now, here's the one that concerns me. Again, I'm looking at the commodity now instead of the hype. This concerns me. The 30-day lead warehouse stock level was very, very high in October. Plummeted to a floor and stayed there all the way till now with a dip in mid-October. So the lead warehouse stock levels over the past 30 days are down. So it means the supply has been used to a large degree. But when I look at the 60-day, I see why. The 60-day, so I go back to September, and lead stockpiles were very, very low, and they were put up very, very high. I actually could go back 6 months and I can watch lead stockpiles fall, floor out, and resupply. So I go back a year and I see then I don't like it. Then I see a continuous down movement of lead supplies. Significant. I go back 5 years and it doesn't look so bad. At 5 years, I see very low stockpiles of lead back in November of 08. Very high ramp up by February 2012, and then a steady drop. Now, does that drop continue? I don't know. I know that a smelter in the United States shutting down, that's the last one, doesn't really help matters much at all. So it's a concern, but when I look at the overall commodity, I don't know how much of a concern it is. So who produces lead right now? Where does lead get produced? And who's the biggest supplier of lead in the world? Well, it turns out the number one producer of lead from mine production is China. 1.4 million metric tons annually. Number two is Australia with 641,000 metric tons annually. Then the United States with 440,000 metric tons annually, followed by Peru and then Mexico. Here's what I see happening. One, yeah, more dependence on China for lead. And China's pretty good at smelting lead and doesn't really care about the environment. It'll smelt the shit out of lead. You know who else will smelt the shit out of lead? Mexico. And do it cheap. And nothing has been done to stop the United States from producing its 440,000 metric tons of lead out of mines. There's lead is a mining byproduct of other mining activities, primarily in the United States. And if anything actually increases the value of lead, it actually incentivizes more of that surplus mining of lead. And we'll ship it to Mexico. And Mexico will ship it right back here, refined. I think that the big picture overall is a very moderate impact on lead prices and lead supplies. I think that we have to understand that, okay, let's say that lead was only used to make bullets. Okay, if lead was only used to make ammunition, then this would be a major, major problem. It really would, definitely. And like I said, the answer is more than just ammo. A lot of cable. Cables are shielded with lead to prevent interference from outside sources of electromagnetic radiation and other symbols. It's used in batteries. Just about every automotive battery on the planet has lead batteries in it. It's used for weights to balance your wheels on your tires. It's used as a lot for a lot of different things. Radiation shield around X-ray array equipment and for nuclear facilities. So lead ain't going away. But the supply line is just about to get a pretty big dadgone hiccup. A lot of ammunition manufacturers actually had strategically located their manufacturing facilities near this smelter. So it's a problem. It's certainly a shot across the bow in the war on guns, but it's not a direct shot. It's an indirect shot. The people doing it are doing it mostly for environmental reasons. That is the true motivation. And again, they'll shed not one tear if it interferes with your ability to have ammunition. But I think you'll find right now, if you want to buy lead for casting and loading your own ammo, or if you want to buy ammunition components made of lead, you'll have no problems with that. You want to buy bullets, not ammo, but bullets right now, they're in plentiful supply. It's a lot harder to get your hands on primers right now than it is lead. So just take that all into consideration before you have a heart attack over this. Let's go totally a different direction. Simple question from Larry. I actually answered this by email, but I get it quite a bit, so I'm going to talk about it because I've mentioned this a couple times. Larry says, what is your advice again for buying a good battery powered chainsaw? I'm looking at a Steel for $350. I was thinking you said a good one runs about $500. So with that, Steel does have a new cordless chainsaw out, and it's probably very good. I have to say, when it comes to chainsaws, regular gas-powered chainsaws, my two recommendations for like the best for your money and longevity have always been between Steel and Husqvarna. And I've actually always said Steel makes a better saw, but it's not enough better for the price difference, in my opinion. A good quality Husqvarna saw is as good as it needs to be for most uses. If you were felling trees as a lumberjack on a daily basis and it was the thing you made your money with, I would probably spend the extra money on a Steel. For people that are going to take good care of their equipment, use a saw frequently but not always, Husqvarna is good enough and a very good piece of equipment. And you couldn't go wrong with either one. So that said, this new Steel chainsaw, which has a 16-inch bar versus a 14-inch bar of the saw that I have, is probably a great tool. And at $350, it's probably a good price, considering the saw that I'm recommending is $400. It doesn't have something, though, that I think really makes this saw viable, and that's an automatic sharpener. And when I say automatic, I mean 1 second, and the chain is razor sharp. It uses a special chain and a little stone for that, and it makes the chain and the little stone that comes with it a little bit more expensive than just buying an off-the-shelf chain, but not so much that it doesn't pay itself back. So I don't have anything bad to say about this new steel saw. And I would love to get my hands on one and run it for a while and see if maybe it actually might even have more power. I don't think that it will. It's a 36-volt lithium-ion battery. The Oregon Power Now, which is what I have, has a 40-volt lithium-ion battery, and you're probably splitting hairs there. You know, you're more looking at amp hours than raw power, but I just don't see either of these saws having a great deal more power than the other one. But I would, again, this is the MS-171 is this new saw from Steel, and it may be a game changer. And when I heard about Oregon saw and started investigating it, it was already clear that Steel had like caught on and like, okay, this is going to be hot and they were going to come out with something. And I had to decide then, do I buy what's available or do I wait? And if Steel sell, and I can't find this thing for sale online. I can only apparently buy this through a Steel dealer and I have to search for a Steel dealer to buy this thing. And, you know, does the price include a battery or charger? I don't know. So it's hard to make an apple for apples comparison right now without getting out to an actual steel dealer. Instead of talking about why the Oregon might be better, let me talk about why I like the Oregon. Because I really believe that when you talk about a product, if you really want to help people, you don't tell them why the other product sucks. You tell them why you believe in the product you believe in, what it does for you, and why you would recommend it. And then, you know, if another product is good or better, they now have the information to make the decision for themselves. And I don't have stock in either one of these companies, and my feelings don't get hurt no matter which one you buy. Here's the deal with the Oregon Power Now. It's a 14-inch bar, and I don't know that there's much utility to having a bigger bar unless, like, Steel has come up with a way to be more powerful using a battery saw. I think that the saw is, when you're using a 14-inch bar, you're pushing the limits of the effective use of that saw. 14 inches is a pretty big piece of wood. I've been cutting live oak with mine since I got it. It does very well on fairly large material, 10, 11-inch material and bigger I've cut with it. I've even cut one tree big enough that I had to actually go in from both sides. It was bigger than the 14 inches the bar would account for in a single cut. And it was able to do that. You're definitely pushing the limits of the saw at that point. So I think the 14-inch bar for a battery-powered saw, where technology currently is, to my knowledge, is as big as it's going to be practical. Adding 2 inches, I don't see it adding a lot to it. The saw has a special chain and a little lever. This is the Oregon saw now. I'm not even going to bring the Steel up anymore. The Oregon saw has a little lever. You run the saw and you pull the little lever. Sparks shoot out and the chain becomes razor sharp in about 1 second. Sooner or later, you do wear out the little sharpener and the chain just doesn't seem to pick up sharp anymore. It took a lot of use on live oak is very hard wood. For me to wear out one chain so far, I've worn out. And I put a new chain on it a couple months ago. I don't have a lot of use on that chain, but it's working just fine. You can change the chain or set the tension on the chain. All you need is a screwdriver. You can hand tighten and hand loosen the side guard for the saw. It works great. Occasionally, it seems that I get it a little tighter and I have to put a pair of pliers to it or something to get it undone. But basically, it's a pretty easy saw to maintain. You put chain oil in it, and other than that, and recharging and replacing the chain when necessary, those are your only inputs. So as long as you have a method of charging, whether it be solar, grid, whatever, and a few chains laid up, you have a very long-term system that you can rely on. It cuts amazingly well, especially if you let the saw do the work. You should always let a chainsaw do the work, but in this case, it's a little bit even more important to really let the saw do the work because the chain is actually designed to pull the saw through the material. And the weight of the saw is all you need for that. And it really does pull itself. You can feel it if you let it happen, pull itself down through that material. And with your blade sharp, it does a great job. Is it as fast as a gas saw? Absolutely, positively not. Is it fast enough for anybody to use? Yes. A little bit of a learning curve when you're cleaning up material. So you've dropped your tree. You got all these little limbs and branches on it. You go through and you take all your small stuff off before you buck the tree, right? Bucking is cutting it into lengths. If you've used a gas saw your entire life, you get in this mentality of keeping that saw revved up. So you're like, nah, 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 nah. Well, it's just electric. It's power on demand. Okay? So when you're going from one to the next, it's a good idea to release the trigger, and you'll get more longevity out of your saw because you're not just running it in the space in between the limbs. So that's something that takes a little bit of getting used to, and it definitely dramatically will improve your runtime of the saw. I have two batteries. The batteries are expensive. The longer lasting battery for the saw is like $200. And when you look at the price of the saw with the battery and the charger being $400, you realize the saw is about $200. Saw and the charger. You're paying almost half the price for the battery, and a replacement battery is expensive. I did get a replacement battery. I have two batteries. I try not to run them all the way down, but you have to pay attention because they're lithium ion. They do not like start to suck. Right? They work. They have this little tiny fraction of time where you can tell they're going down in power, but they're still adequate to do anything you want to do, and then they're dead. I try not to do that. The batteries have a little gauge on them. You push the button, the lights light up and show you full, three quarters, half. When it gets down to one quarter, I swap batteries. As long as I'm paying attention, I try to do that. I think that is better for the life of the battery and not beating on it so hard, a total discharge. They're rated for 2,000 charges. If you think about it that way, if you were to use each battery twice a week, if you were to use each battery twice a week, it's 19 years if you do the math. Each battery twice a week, each battery would then last you 19 years on the charging cycles alone. Say it's 10. A couple batteries and a way to charge them and some stored up oil and a few chains. You've got a very long life cycle even in a grid down scenario. As long as you've got backup power from your vehicle or a generator to charge or a solar array or what have you. So I see this as being a very long life product. My experience in running the piss out of it, honestly, for the period of time that I've owned it, about 8 months now, tells me that that probably is indeed the case. The saw runs like it did the day I bought it, and I've used it pretty hard. Who is it best for? If you are a small property owner, even a large property owner, that you use a chainsaw a couple times, three, four times a month, and you're generally cutting smaller trees and things like that, doing pruning, cutting stuff to length, and you want to be able to just grab a saw, not worry about oil mixing and all this other crap and taking a chain off with a file and sharpening it and all this other stuff, and just does it start for you on the first pull, and is it cold out today, or you know what have you, and did you bring the saw out and forget to bring your gas with you, and it's low on, you just want to pick it up and use it, and you're using it for a lot of use but not excessive use, and you're cutting mostly trees that you know maybe you can't get your hands around, but you have no problem getting, you know, putting in a headlock style lock, you know, stuff that's in a 10 inch and down range. And you're doing a lot of pruning, it's great. It's lightweight. You're getting up to trees on ladders. You're having to top stuff, things like that. It's lightweight and easy to use in those situations. The power's there. It's got great kickback response. It actually probably is too sensitive. If the thing binds at all, it engages the chain break. I see it as being as safe as a chainsaw can be. Chainsaws are dangerous tools. I mean, in general, chainsaws are dangerous tools. You need to know what you're doing with a chainsaw. You probably should work with somebody that really knows what they're doing and has used a chainsaw to learn certain things, especially when you start dropping trees. You know, when you drop a tree, well, the first thing you do is determine where the tree's supposed to fall. And then you determine two paths at 45 degrees away from that location the tree's supposed to fall. You go to those paths and say, is anything in the way? And you move it, cut yourself a clearing, what have you. So you have two ways you can run away when the tree starts to go that are as opposite as possible without going directly behind where you've planned the tree to fall and completely clear, and you've thought that out. And then when you go to drop that tree, if anything goes wrong and it doesn't fall where you intended it, you've got two different totally opposite pathways to take to get clear and safe. If you don't know that already, you probably should take a basic safety course with chainsaws or something before you do much with them, especially if you're going to drop trees. It is a great way to get yourself killed if you don't know what you're doing. People often think, well, I'll go cut all the dead trees on my property. A dead tree is far more dangerous than a live tree. I've seen dead trees, a guy starts cutting a tree and a tree fall over, not where you're cutting it, at the roots. I've seen that happen. I've seen somebody start cutting a tree and the top of the tree fall off and almost kill a guy cutting a tree. Because when you start vibrating a tree, the dead up at the top comes loose. And I've seen trees that don't look that big, and what comes out of them big enough to seriously injure and or kill somebody. So when I say it's safe, I'm saying it's safe relative to the concept that it's a chainsaw and what you might be doing with a chainsaw. In other words, it's no more dangerous than any other chainsaw, all of which are dangerous and even more dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. But I think this is probably one of the best small property landscape owner type thing. If you had a landscaping company and you're routinely having to prune trees and stuff, this is, you know, when you get beyond what a reciprocating saw will do well for you with pruning, and you're taking out small trees, cutting firewood, cutting hugel beds, this thing's awesome. On a steel, is it as good? I don't know. If anybody owns one, I'd love to hear from you. I would really love to hear from somebody that's run both of these saws. Or if anybody's local and you own the steel, I would love you to bring it by, and I'd love to do a side-by-side comparison of the two saws. I think I'm gonna bet that the steel might have a power advantage just because steel really knows what they're doing when it comes to building power in a saw. But the Oregon is going to have the automatic sharpening advantage, and I think that that might outweigh it because, you know, a saw with a little less power but a razor-sharp blade at all times, that's what makes this thing really shine. You will have a sharp blade because it's so easy to make it sharp, you'll do it. Anyway, I went long on that, but I just think it's a great tool. And if you have the money and you're considering a chainsaw, let me put it to you, cut and dry. You can go buy a chainsaw from Walmart for $112, a little pulling, 16-inch, 14-inch bar, and it'll run great, and it will outcut this $400 saw in speed and performance the day you buy it. That will not be the case a year from now. When the chain's dull and you're trying to sharpen it and the engine's been run hard and, I mean, all these, you know, it just really won't. It won't have the longevity that this saw will, in my opinion, thus far. Let's take another one of your emails. The next one I want to read from you, for a little perspective, requires knowledge of what happened last week on a call-in show. I answered a call for an individual with type 1 diabetes that basically has said that he knows that if the shit hits the fan big enough, a clock starts to his death. And I got on him pretty hard because I said, you're basically planning to die. And it's fine to acknowledge the weakness and limitation, but you need to plan to survive. And I really can't help you until you start doing that. And I was kind of tough on him. This email comes from John in Florida. And here's what John says about my response to that individual. And it's the other side of the perspective from a diabetic issue. And I think you should hear the other side and how the other side of this issue thinks. And when I say other side, I mean somebody with a different plan, not a plan to die. John says, thank you for what I describe as a non-sugar-coated, diabetic-friendly, motivational speech. I am not the type 1 diabetic in my family. My wife is, and we have planned around that illness. My wife can only be described as the polar opposite of your caller. We have the backup insulin, and she has a fight to the last attitude. The attitude extends to the point where she has discussed raiding pharmacies and residential mental health facilities with me. I end up being the one advising her to pump the brakes a bit so we can think about crossing that bridge if we ever are in a position where we absolutely need to cross it. I've been listening to your podcast for a couple of years, but she has never listened to it until I played that kick in the rear for her. She was shaking her head as the caller talked, but as you got into your response, you could see her eyes light up, and she actually said, F yeah, and who is this guy? By the way, I don't censor a lot of speech on the air, but I don't use the F word. I'm telling you that in this article, the lady did not censor her speech. She didn't just say F yeah, she said the F word, which, and I think in that case, it carries some emphasis with it that I don't need to put on air, but I appreciate it, and I probably would have said the same thing in that private one-on-one situation. A couple of times before you finished, she said this. It seems you may have gained another listener. Anyway, thank you again. I can't know if your response positively changed your caller, but it redoubled our motivation to keep to our plans. And it made me wonder if you know any reliable information sources for extracting human usable swine insulin. That's another contingency we have discussed, but we have been unable to locate anything reputable. Thanks again, John. John, I don't know anything about that, but let me tell you, there's people who would say, oh, how horrible is it that this lady would steal insulin to stay alive? And the same person would say, but if it came down to it, eventually I'd steal food. Is there any difference? And I say no. I say no, there's no difference. I think most of us want to believe, and this is what what John was saying to his wife, let's pump the brakes on that, right? Let's not go, you know, planning on raiding, you know, you know, Costco's pharmacy or, you know, I'm trying to look, Eckerd Drugs is stuck in my head. I'm trying to think of another drugstore, you know, that's real popular around here. And I just, Walgreens pharmacy, and there's one other one that's big time pharmacy. And let's not plan on raiding all those to steal insulin, unless we have to cross that bridge. But you know what? The mentality of the person with the affliction saying, if that's what it takes, as a last resort, I'll do it, probably means they'll never have to. It probably means they'll never have to. Because they won't let themselves get into that situation in all but the most dire situation. And as I said last week, the most dire situation is the least likely scenario that we'll get into. But you have to plan to survive, folks. The contingencies for if you do not are very valid and very real, and we have them in daily life all the time. Life insurance would be one. You know, if you're a single person and you don't have life insurance, I don't really care. They'll figure out what to do with your dead stinking carcass when you die. But if you have anybody in your life depending on you, you should have basic life insurance to replace your income for 5 to 10 years minimum and to deal with your final expenses. And so that the people that love you can take some time, a few weeks at least, and not have to worry about working and pay, you know, do they have time off? And, you know, your wife or your husband has some money to put your children in some counseling if they're young, because they're going to need it. Maybe it's only a 2 or 3 sessions with, by the way, I'm advising you right now, if this ever happens to you, someone that does not use drugs. Do not take your children dealing with severe grief to someone who can prescribe medication to them, or they'll do it. When my son's birth father passed away, my wife and I knew we needed something beyond what we could say to make him feel better. That he needed to talk this out with somebody, and we took him to someone, and that was a person that was able to prescribe medication. They spoke to him for about 10 minutes and then said he was depressed clinically and needed medication. I resisted the urge to smash his head into the brick wall behind him. It was very difficult for me to do. My wife then found a counselor who does not use medications, who saw him about 4 to 6 sessions, if I remember, and on the last session said he doesn't need me anymore. But you know what? We were able to afford that. You might leave behind a situation where your spouse can't. So life insurance is important. And this is a contingency in case you die. But you don't buy insurance because you're like, well, I'm going to be dead next year. You buy insurance as a contingency because you could be. And folks, I don't care if you're a diabetic, I don't care if you're a quadriplegic, I don't care what you are, when you're planning to deal without system support, plan to live. Have a desire to live. Have a desire to continue. You're worth it, and the people that care about you are worth it. And if you're not going to do that, then when the shit is the fan, you might as well just climb onto something high and do a swan dive. Because sooner or later, you're going to end up there anyway. It's about the attitude first and the physicality second. That said, if like I was 5 years ago, you weigh 300 pounds, get your fat ass moving and lose some weight. I did. And I was smart enough not to go telling you that until I did it. Because you would have been like, well, who's this lard ass to tell me to lose weight? And I could have said, well, I'm a lard ass losing weight. And you would have said, yeah, whatever, right? But I'll tell you now, if you are overweight, lose weight. Paleo is one way you might be able to do that. If not, find something, stick to it, and put yourself into better shape. If you're a diabetic, be working the hell out. Develop yourself physically to the highest level that you can, so that if you end up in this crisis situation, you're better able to deal with it. A diabetic that exercises, works out, watches what they eat, stays on it 100% all the time with a reserve of insulin of 30 days is probably more likely to survive 90 days of grid down than one that has 60 days of insulin and is fat, overweight, obese, lazy, and not paying attention to what's going on. And I can say that about any illness or any disability out there. If you're on medication that's maintenance medication that you believe is necessary to keep you alive, do an evaluation to whether or not that's really true. and start asking yourself, can I find a doctor that will work with me to get me the hell off of this? If you're a type 1 diabetic, the answer to that is no. But there's many other illnesses, psychological and physical both, that people are on medication for that they should not be. If you have a doctor telling you to go on a maintenance medication you're going to be on for the rest of your life, please think before you do it. Please think before you do it. There's someone I know, I won't say who, the person might be mad at me if I did, that was recently told by a doctor, you need blood pressure medication. You need it. If you were my mom or my dad, I would make the same recommendation to you. This is important. You need this medication. Just a little bit. Just a small amount, but your blood pressure is a little bit high. On my advice, this person waited 30 days, took their blood pressure multiple times a day. At the end of that 30 days, looked at their blood pressure and went, this is not a blood pressure that needs to be medicated. You know what? When you're worried about your blood pressure and you go to the doctor while you're worried about your blood pressure and anxious to be at the doctor in the first place, and they take your blood pressure will be higher than it normally is. You want to see it? Convince somebody that they are having heart problems and take their blood pressure. It'll go up 20 to 30 points from anxiety while you're doing it alone. If you're on blood pressure medication, do not stop taking your blood pressure medication. And you may not, if you've been on a certain amount of time under certain conditions, you may never be able to stop taking it. You got a real problem then. Then you got to make sure you have the reserves. I'm convinced my buddy Hal Dodd that died a couple years ago died because he went off of blood pressure medication. I'm also convinced that he probably should have never went on it, and he'd probably still be alive if he didn't. I'm not saying ignore doctor recommendations. I'm saying start thinking before you go into these situations where you become dependent on a medication for the rest of your life. Plan to survive and do everything you can to increase those odds. Never write yourself off. How many times can I tell you that if you ask oncologists, they'll tell you the cancer patient, it survives. Even when they follow the same course of treatment, aggressive or moderate, doesn't matter, is always the one that's a pain in the ass, that always wants to know why they're doing everything, that knows what they do matters and fights for life. Doesn't mean you can always win that fight. Sometimes a disease wins. Sometimes a gravel truck wins when it runs over your car and kills you. There are always things that will take away the life of individuals because we're mortal. Every single human being on this planet has a terminal disease. It's called life. And at the same time that life is terminal, it's the greatest gift you've ever been given. Make the most out of it. In all times, good and bad. Let's take another one.
Here's a very interesting question that hits home to me from Daniel. Daniel says, how can I incorporate large limestone boulders into garden swales and ponds? I recently bought a house on an acre of land in Virginia that is full of limestones and boulders, just under the surface of the ground. The rocks are anywhere from a couple feet in diameter to the size of a car. Many are part of larger underground formations. I have somewhere in the ballpark of 7,000 to 8,000 square feet of roof space. I'd like to use the feed a series of ponds, but I'm not sure about building ponds and swales around my rocks. Specifically, will a rock protruding through the bottom of a pond cause leaks, or will approximately my 20 ducks take care of that? Duck shit, by the way, is a great way to seal ponds. But the pond has to hold water first. It can leak, but it has to hold water for the ducks to get in there and do their thing. Just before I even get to the main part of that. How can I use the rocks to my advantage in areas that will be swaled? Can I blast the rocks out of the way if need be? I'm sure there's a better solution. Thanks for all you do. Finding your show has changed my life and helped secure my family's future. Daniel, a lot of people are laughing right now. If you've seen my videos and know what my property's like or you've been here. I probably have worse problems with limestone than Daniel does. I have places where my soil is only 4 inches deep before I hit chunk limestone, and in some cases even slab, these bigger formations that Daniel's talking about. Usually when you have limestone like this, you're looking at ancient ocean bed. When you dig up the stuff that's here, you see it's full of oyster shells and fossils and things like that. It looks like concrete, and in some ways that's what it is. It's like a natural conglomerate rock of concrete. It's very hard in some situations and quite soft in others. It can be broken up. at times pretty easily and at other times not so much. And once you hit the flat slab, yeah, unless you're bringing in like a, you know, a 25-ton excavator with a jackhammer attachment on it or explosives or something, you're pretty well sunk. You're not moving it. When you get not just the chunks, I mean, you can move some of the size of a car with a pretty small machine, honestly. A little 6,000-pound excavator, Mini-X, will dig out and move that eventually if it's what you really want to do. But when you hit Mother Earth and you're hitting a slab of something that's attached to basically an old reformation, you've got to break it up to move it, and that's a problem. What I'd really need to know whether ponds are feasible on your property or not is how – is there any place where you have a place where you can get deeper? Just under the surface of the ground. To some people, that's 2 feet. To some people, that's 2 inches. To some people, that's 4 feet. I'm going to guess it's somewhere in the 2 feet to 2 inches range, and then the answer might be – depending on your slope and topography, do you have any elevation to work with? That the answer may be it's not feasible because it's not here. I have one spot where maybe it is. This would be a place to get local pond builders that have built ponds in your area out there to look at it and see if they think they can do it. Okay, and the answer may very well be no, or yeah, we can, but boy, is it going to cost you. Will a rock protruding through the bottom of your pond cause the pond to leak? Absolutely yes. Rock and pond are not compatible. At very best, what you would be looking at in your situation is if you can find a place where you can get enough depth and use the topography to get into the 6-foot depth range with the deeper water in your pond and the size it makes sense to do, and you can move the earth and build into the contours to get that 6 foot of depth, which means you need more than that because your dam wall needs to have freeboard of at least a foot or two. So now you need 7 to 8 feet at your dam wall to your deepest part of your impounded area. And you need more than that because you're probably looking at trucking in bentonite and putting down 4 to 8 inches of bentonite, which of course takes away from your depth, and running that into the soil. And if you can do that, you can probably force a pond in, and maybe it makes sense to do. I would have to look at your land, see the contours, and probably I'd have to physically be there, and it would cost you a lot less to have some, because I'm not doing it, honestly. And even if I did, it would cost you a fortune for me to come up to Virginia to do this. Get a local pond builder in that's dealt with these tough situations and say, does it work? And they might say, yeah, here's how we could do it. And then you can look at swaling into that, maybe, because the swales are something I'm going to talk about next. But ponds may be out of the question. What we're doing here, I found a source of non-expanding clay for $3 a yard. That's pretty cheap. It's not enough that I would be comfortable with that lining, but I'm comfortable building a great big berm out of it in a big circle, excavating everything inside that circle to about a depth of about 6 to 8 inches down to a rock base. Building up the berm and then laying an EDPM pond liner over it, and getting about a 4 foot deep pond out of this with a couple spots that we found that we can get really, really deep down about like, you know, a little deeper than that anyway, another foot or two deeper. And then after the pond liner's down, putting down about a 1 foot depth of really high quality dirt fill, stuff that'll grow and we can cover crop and stabilize everything with, and put a pond in that way, and we're going to recharge it from roof runoff and from a 1,500 to 2,500-gallon poly tank, depending on what we decide to put in. It'll work. It's not ideal. We'll probably have to initially fill it with well water over a several-week period to not overtax the pump and the aquifer. And it will require some maintenance, but it'll hold somewhere between, depending on what we end up doing as a final design, 40,000 to 60,000 gallons of water. I'll put some fish in it. It'll give the geese something to swim around in. It'll be nice and a usable, cool-looking feature in the landscape, but it won't be built into the ground, and so it won't be self-sustaining unless we put in infrastructure to make it so. That may be the only way that you can do a pond. I'm sorry, but there's limits to what you can do, especially when you have limits to your financial thing. Swales, different matter. I have an area that we're doing our workshop in a few weeks at, November 20th through 23rd or 21st to 23rd, something like that. We have about 6 to 8 inches of depth before we hit chunky rock and a little bit more before we hit slab. We go down about a foot. We're bringing in an excavator. We're going to dig swales. Instead of digging swales that normally would be, you know, 6 foot wide by 3 feet deep, we're going to build swales that are six feet wide, maybe wider, depending on what the machine can do when it gets here, and maybe a foot deep, 10 inches deep. When we get too much into the rock, we'll stop. We want to make sure that we don't go as deep as we can everywhere so that we make sure we can get as deep as we need to be level through the whole swale. And we're going to pile out and tail out the berm on a longer, lower profile so that we get more soil buildup. And my soil's beautiful down to the rock. It doesn't even have stratified layers. It's not topsoil and then subsoil. It's all gorgeous clay loam. And a lot of times on limestone, for some reason, that's what you end up with. And we'll then bring in a top dressing of really high-quality lava sand compost mix. 60% compost, 20% lava sand, 30% cushion sand. Really good sandy soil mix with high organic matter as a kind of a top dressing. We'll plant that and we'll build into it. We're trying to leave most of the rock in the ground. I don't want to bring a lot of the boulders up. Limestone generally doesn't look that great, and there's not a lot of advantage to it being in contact with water in a pond. It's going to move the water more toward an alkaline state. Probably all the water on your property already is alkaline. Moving more into that direction is probably not the best thing. If you end up with rock up out of the ground, all you can do is work with it. Figure out where it'll look good. One thing you know about rock, it creates 100% runoff. How do you create an advantage with rock? Structure the rock somewhere with kind of natural pilings and plantings that can handle the small pockets and things like that. But put it somewhere that when water hits it and runs off, the water will be harvested. Try to make it look as aesthetically pleasing as possible. But I think you'll find with most busted up limestone, if you end up taking a lot of it out of the ground, you end up having to haul it away or bury it in something. We're putting in platforms right now for our water tanks to keep them about a foot off the ground to give us more gravity feed out of them. And we're doing that with a frame built out of timbers, and then we're filling it with cheap fill, like highly packed fill, rock fill. It's actually crushed limestone, large degree. And then the very top we're doing with sand because it's easy to level and put the tank on it, and at that point, so last couple inches of us packed sand on top of this packed limestone. But we have piles of limestone everywhere from other excavations. And the first thing Joe and I are doing when we get the frame built, before we start bringing the fill that we're paying in for, we're throwing as much of it as we can in there to bury it and get rid of it, to hide it. So be careful with how much of that crap you bust out of the ground, unless you start figuring out some ways to make it look kind of cool. Because I find it's not like granite where it looks really neat. It kind of looks ugly. Now, here's the hope that you have. In some ways, you can destroy it with trees. When we're digging this up right now, we just dug two swales by hand last week. We're finding places where it's shallower. So we got this nice deep, we can go down a good 6 inches before we start hitting the chunks of rock. And while some we're hitting the chunks of rock at like 2 inches underground. Where we're hitting it, in this particular instance, it's not really where the slab or formation has come up. It's where trees have grown. Push the roots between the chunk and the slab and push the chunk up. And that's made it appear more shallow. Those rocks, a lot of them, when we pull them out, have an orange clay-like appearance to them. The rock has softened and the tree and biology is actually breaking it down. And we pulled out big chunks, big old hunk you can barely pick up. And I can take it in my hands in some instances and I can break it. And then we'll pull up another hunk. You beat with a sledgehammer really, really hard before you get it to break up. And some of it is almost impossible to even break with a hammer. So it's a weird thing, but we're actually finding places where nature's eating the limestone. So if you were going to put swales in it like I'm going to do, I would tell you massive amounts of support trees. We're going to do a 7-to-1 ratio. So we build our swales. We're going to put in 40 mainframe species in this project. We're going to do 280 leguminous support trees, mimosas, mesquites, things like that. Chop and drop for 5 years. Massive amount of root structure into the ground. Massive amount of biology into the ground. Building topsoil up and breaking rock down at the same time. It's probably the best you can do with it. I'm not afraid of a property like this, or I wouldn't have one, but you're going to have to accept there's some limitations. And the best advice I can give you with ponds, get someone from the area who has done ponds in these harsh environments to evaluate their property, your property. Someone that's actually done it. Let them show you what they've done. Some pictures, or say it's over there, you can go look at it. And if they then tell you, I can do this, you probably can be reasonably confident they can and that they'll stick to the timeline and budget they give you. If a person who's done it says, I wouldn't do it here, it's probably best that you trust what they tell you. So hopefully that'll help you. But yeah, if you have rocks protruding into your soil layer in a pond, it's not going to seal for you. Because, yes, ducks shitting in a leaky pond will eventually seal it up. It works very, very well, especially in small ponds. Very well. But the pond must first be able to hold water. It will fix a leaky dam. It won't make a dam that doesn't hold water at all hold water. Just on that note there. Let's go ahead and take another one. Okay, this next one basically is paramount to admission by government itself that their policies with modern food production are stupid and definitely endangering our health and safety. Because what I'm about to read from you is going to sound like it comes off like some, you know, Dr. McCullough website or something like that, or Andrew Weil, or, you know, something like alternative health. But this is on Homeland Security's digital library blog. How animal antibiotics threaten public health. So give this a listen. Again, this is the Homeland Security digital library blog. The website is hsdl.org. And I mean, it's so obvious that this is basically saying how bad this is and admitting that, you know, and it's not written like we're wrong, but like you come up with the conclusion of they're wrong. That I checked into the site to make sure it was actually Homeland Security digital library blog, and it is. Here we go. In industrial food animal production, using antibiotics as a preventative measure rather than a therapeutic one has been common practice for several decades. Now a study by Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future finds the continued overuse of antibiotics in livestock has led to dangerous effects in people, including the decreased effectiveness of antibiotics used for treating human infections. The study called Industrial Food Animal Production in America, Examining the Impact of the Pew Commission's Priority Recommendations, blames the continued use of unnecessary antibiotics in livestock on policies that are lobbied by the agricultural and pharmaceutical industries. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, says that antibiotic-resistant threats are on the rise, and at least 2 million people a year become infected with these bacteria. At least 23,000 cases cause death each year. The CDC is very clear on the causes of these increases. Quote, up to half of antibiotic use in humans and much of antibiotic use in animals is unnecessary and inappropriate and makes everyone less safe. Stopping even some of the inappropriate and unnecessary use of antibiotics in people and animals would help greatly in slowing down the spread of resistant bacteria, end quote. The JHCLF report strongly recommends discontinuing the use of antimicrobials in food animals unless the animals are diagnosed with illness. Chronic administration in low doses, says the study, quote, contributes to the evolution and proliferation of antimicrobial resistant strains of bacteria, end quote. The Homeland Security Digital Library has a wide variety of materials related to chronic infection, which pose a unique security risk to the United States. Read more about this topic and more here, and there's a link. I'll put a link to this in today's show notes and to many other things that we've talked about today. I'll tell you, that's only part of the problem. That's only part of the problem. And it's a pretty big problem, isn't it? More and more infectious diseases and bacteria are able to get a toehold, infect a person or an animal, and kill it, and resist the antibiotic that we've come to depend on as being effective in its treatment. 23,000 cases of death a year to these infections. 2 million people infected. And a lot of people that don't die are seriously impacted by these illnesses. Some for the rest of their lives. Because we're giving an animal an antibiotic every day, whether it needs it or not. Think about it this way. There's a lot of diseases that if you get as a human being and you're diagnosed with it, your doctor might prescribe an antibiotic, and at least for now, it's pretty effective. It works. I'm not saying it doesn't. Not saying you always need it, even when it does work, but it does work. But you would not take in a little bit of an antibiotic every day just to be a preventative measure. Unless you're an idiot. And we don't do that with people, but we do it with animals. Let me explain something that I think most people just don't get. When you eat an animal, you're eating whatever it ate. If you are constantly dosing an animal with antibiotics, and you eat that animal, you are constantly taking in a low dose of that antibiotic yourself. So what you've just said you wouldn't do, our system is getting you to do. And this is not just true of antibiotics. It's true of any hormone therapy the animal's given. It's true of anything the animal's eating that's been treated with an herbicide or a pesticide. Folks, we're eating on a daily basis in this country, not just refined carbohydrates, not just food additives. We're eating pesticides, herbicides, hormones, and antibiotics in our food system. And even people that you would look at their diet and say are eating relatively healthy are eating those four things. So you're reducing your body's ability to fight infection, you're creating chronic inflammation, and you're introducing chemical responses in your body that your body was never meant to be exposed to. I'm not a health nut, but I know the entire way we're running our food system today is money driven at the expense of health. I don't believe, like some people do, that the people behind this are doing this so that you get sick and so that you die. I believe the people doing this are doing this to make money, and they don't care that you get sick or die. But the pharmaceutical industry, which is largely owned by the same people, kind of is happy with the whole sick thing. If you make drugs, you don't make money by making people well. You make money by treating sick people. The longer they're sick, the more they use your medications, the more money you make. But in this instance, what we're doing is we're taking something that actually is a great gift to humanity. Antibiotic drugs saved millions of lives over the years and rendering it not only ineffective, but in some ways deadly. But let's just keep doing things the same way we always have. If you want to know why I put such an emphasis on growing your own food, permaculture, developing your own food sources, here you go. It's not just if the shit has hit the fan. It's that the shit has already hit the fan. We live in a society where the average person is consuming toxins on purpose. And policy of our government and our industry supports the continued use thereof. The actual thing that's encouraging to see this article on a major Department of Government's website is at least, even now, officially, they're starting to acknowledge the problems. I don't know if we can fix all of this, and I certainly don't depend on government to do it, but at least if we'll acknowledge it, we're taking a step in the right direction. Again, links to this and many other things I've talked about today, today's show notes, episode 1240. But let me go one step further with it. It's kind of funny. I got that email I just read a story to you from Mike. Mike sent me the one on the Homeland Security blog. Darby Simpson sent me an article. It's the next one in my queue. Not because I, you know, picked it out, but I mean, I literally got these two emails within like half hour of each other. It's in the Daily Mail. Seems like the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom, you know, publishes all the valuable information that American citizens should know that our own media won't report. And once again, they're doing the same thing. Here's the headline. We've reached the end of antibiotics. Sensationalism? Crazy crackpot health people? Something like that? No. Let me read the rest of it. We've reached the end of antibiotics. Top CDC expert declares that miracle drugs that have saved millions are no match against superbugs because people have over-medicated themselves. A high-ranking official with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has declared in an interview with PBS that the age of antibiotics has come to an end. Quote, for a long time there have been newspaper stories and covers of magazines that talked about the end of antibiotics with question marks, said Dr. Arjun Svervensen. Well, now I would say you can change the title to the end of antibiotics, period. The associate director, guys, get this. The associate director of the CDC sat down with Frontline over the summer for a lengthy interview about the growing problem of antibacterial resistance. Cervenson, who is also featured in Frontline report called Hunting the Nightmare Bacteria, which aired Tuesday, said that both humans and livestock have been over-medicated to such a degree the bacteria are now resistant to antibiotics. We're in a post-antibiotic era, he said. There were patients for whom we have no therapy, and we are literally in a position of having a patient in the bed who has an infection, something that 5 years ago even we could have treated, but now we can't. Dr. Cervenson offered an example of this notion, citing a recent case of three Tampa Bay Buccaneer players who made headlines after reportedly contracting potentially deadly MRSA infections, which until recently were largely restricted to hospitals. These are football players, not Buccaneers, guys. These people are, you know, at least on the surface, very healthy people. About 10 years ago, the CDC officials began seeing outbreaks of different kinds of MRSA infections in schools and gyms. In hospitals, when you see MRSA infections, you oftentimes see that patients who have a catheter in their blood, and that creates an opportunity for MRSA to get into the bloodstream, he said. In the community, it was causing a very different type of infection, causing a lot of very, very serious and painful infections of the skin, which was completely different from what we would see in healthcare. With bacteria constantly evolving and developing resistance to conventional antibiotics, doctors have been forced to reach back into the archives and dust off older, more dangerous cures like Hostelin. It is very toxic, said Cervenson. We don't like to use it. It damages the kidneys, but we're forced to use it in a lot of instances. The expert went on saying that the discovery of antibiotics in 1928 by Professor Alexander Fleming revolutionized medicine, allowing doctors to treat hundreds of millions of people suffering from illnesses that have been considered terminal for centuries. Antibiotics also paved the way for successful oral organ transplants, chemotherapy, stem cell and bone marrow transplantations, all procedures that weaken the immune system and make the body susceptible to infections. However, the CDC director explained that people have fueled the fire of bacterial resistance through rampant overuse and misuse of antibiotics. These drugs are miracle drugs, these antibiotics that we have, but we haven't taken good care of them over the last 50 years we've had them, he told Frontline. Cervenson added that the pharmaceutical companies are at least partially to blame for this problem, saying they have neglected the development of new and more sophisticated antibiotics that could keep up with bacterial resistance because, quote, there's not much money to be made in this field. The Center of Disease Control just ended his interview by saying the reason they're not making these things that cure disease very well is there's not much money in them. The crazy survivalist Jack Spirico just told you in the last story that they liked people sick so they could treat illness. They didn't want to make people well. The director of the CDC tends to agree with me. Shocking, I know. Shocking. Maybe there is some light at the end of the tunnel, but how dark does it have to get before anybody's willing to look back for the light? What do I think the solution to this is? Yeah, you got to stop this crap. Unless someone is ill enough that they're severely risking their health, they don't need an antibiotic, period. You know, getting over an infection a day early is not an advocation to use a freaking antibiotic and build a stronger bug. It's not. Well, this and that. Well, it's not going to work for anybody soon. So this guy's saying, the solution to our own lives? Build your health and your immune systems. Get off of all this crap that's making you susceptible to it. Yeah, Tampa Bay Buccaneer football players are getting infected with this stuff. Well, there's a couple things at play here. One, they're in very wet environments surrounded by a lot of other people in their locker rooms. That's part of it. They're engaged in a physical activity that ends up a lot of times making you bleed. I don't know if you've ever played football. I did. And you bleed quite a bit. So you have skin, you break your skin. And then, you know, these close quarters locker room environments are just breeding places for bacteria. But they're probably also eating what you would call a healthy diet, but it's probably full of garbage. It's not McDonald's fries. Most Buccaneers players are probably not living on McDonald's fries. Even the guys that you think of as fat linemen, they're probably eating lots of meat. They're probably very well conditioning themselves, but they're probably eating mostly meat that comes out of mainstream production. Full of what? Antibiotics and hormones and pesticides and herbicides that the animals are eating. I'm just saying. You want to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. You need to be focused on your health as much as anything else. Certainly as much as guns. You want to focus on emergency medical response to these situations. What do you do in a crisis if there's no doctor and something goes wrong? First step, build your health so that you're better able to deal with something if it does go wrong. Well, folks, we're well over an hour now, and I kind of want to finish up today with a little different take than I've been doing with these feedback shows lately, because I've really hammered on the problem a lot. And I've talked about the solution, and I constantly talk about solutions. I constantly bring on guests telling you different things that you can do in your own life for more independence and liberty and self-sufficiency. But I think every once in a while, we kind of need to end with just a rational look at the world and the place around us. I think the first thing you're going to have to do to be happy as a prepper slash modern survivalist slash call yourself whatever you want. And don't let anybody, don't let anybody assign the label to you. You decide who and what you are, and say what you are and be what you are. And don't let anybody assign that to you, but don't be afraid to be known either. I just answered an email from somebody that asked me about Oath Keepers and my opinion and all, and I responded with the following. I said, after me being a founding member, talking about them on my show, flying their banner on my site, really, what else would you want from me? What are you looking for? For me to proclaim Stuart Rhodes a saint to the Church of Jack or something like that? I mean, what else could I tell you that would, say anything more about how honorable and great of an organization that I think it is? And the response was, I'm more interested in a practical, response of, do you think it's a list that the government would use to find? My response was, if you're worried about being known in the society that we're in now, and I didn't explain this, so maybe the person will listen and hear this. What I mean by that is, you're known. If you oppose tyranny in our society today and have been active in any way whatsoever, you're known. You're on a list. Tell them to dot the I and cross the T when they write your name. I mean, I'm all for fighting the surveillance state, but I'm not going to hide who I am either. But what I finished with is, in this day and age, you can stand or you can kneel. Choose wisely. When I did my podcast about Oath Keepers, that's what I said. And at that time, I was saying it to those who have taken the oath, those who have sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of your nation or your state or both, that you're going to be asked in the future to stand or to kneel, and to choose to stand. Well, today I'm saying that to everybody. Stand. The biggest solution in this nation is for people to stop being afraid. What if we don't have this? What if we don't have that? What if they know this? What if they do that? What if, what if, what if? I think of the old, do you think Jim Carrey was the first one to say it? If ifs and buts were candies and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas. Maybe that's older than him. I don't exactly like that guy anymore, but really, if ifs and buts were candy and nuts. What if we stopped being a bunch of sorry asses and said, bring it on? What if we stood the hell up like the people were supposed to be? What if we stopped asking or talking about how great America is and did it? What if people that are in the teacup and China plate generations that keep saying, well, it's not all us, we're not all you, stood up and said, here it is. This is the next generation. These are those of us who are not willing to lay down. What if the people in my generation, Gen X, started to stand more? And some of us are. But what if we all stood? What if the next time the government came out and said, oh, if we don't do this, then this program will fail. And we said, we don't give a shit. We don't care. Tough. Close it. Now. Do it. Done. We don't need it. We don't need you. We don't need anything that you're offering anymore. You've done enough. Please remove some things. Go ahead. We'll be okay. We'll look at it. And we didn't just say it. We meant it. And we did it. What if the next time somebody said, oh, well, you know, no one would take care of poor people if, and that day you took an action or wrote a check or did something to help a poor person, one that actually deserved it, took some food down to a food bank, went and served soup at a kitchen, wrote a check to a charity that actually does what they say they do, something like that. What if you're a pissed off next generationer, young teacup generationer, 18, 19, 20, and the next time I said something about the teacup generation, instead of getting pissed off and sending me an email that tells me how you're not all that way, you went and did something to prove it. What if the next time you thought about how bad your food supply was, you went out and planted at least 4 or 5 plants that would produce something for you? What if? Can we make what if something positive for a change? I'll tell you how you make what if positive. You ask the question, it leads to an action, then you take it. What if the government makes a list of oath keepers? What if the government makes a list of oath keepers and there's 5 million freaking people on it? Huh? What about that? Oh, it's a list of the most prepared people. Oh, good Lord. Have you made a comment on Facebook about doomsday preppers? You're probably on that list already, whether you should be or not. But what if? What if the Oath Keepers roster was 5 million or 10 million people? Let me quote one of our greatest founders to you right now. When people fear their government, there is tyranny. When the government fears its people, there is liberty. Of course, that's from Thomas Jefferson. It is time for us to stop behaving like cowards. Even many of us in the prepper community that are worried, they'll know. I want them to know. I want them to know that we are prepared. We are prepared to take care of ourselves. That we are prepared to stand in the face of tyranny. That we are not prepared to lay down and be quiet when they shit on the last of our liberty and wipe their butts with our Constitution. That we are not prepared for that. We are prepared to stand. That there is a line with which we will not let them cross, and we will publicly state so. Because let me tell you something about bureaucrats. They're not as stupid as you would think they are. And they know that if there's 1 million people that publicly state and mean that they will do something, there's probably about 10 to 1 of people that will, when it becomes necessary, that don't say anything. But you can be the silent majority, or you can choose to start being the vocal and active minority, because they're the ones that get listened to. Oh, you can call your senator. He won't give a shit. But making a statement that you will survive and that you will not let some lines be crossed, and doing so with boldness, sooner or later, that starts to make an impact. Why do you think there's all this interest in preparedness now? Because they can make money on it? You bet. But it's because enough people have been heard that they know. That they know. I've had somebody ask me one time, well, Jack, what if they came after you? Bring it on. Bring it on. It would be a very dumb thing for the government to attack me. It would make my message so much more powerful. It would be the greatest marketing and PR campaign I could ever put together. I couldn't get investors to come up with $1 million, go to a marketing agency, and make a better marketing campaign and reach more people than I could if the government were to come tell me right now that I have to take my garden away. Or that I have to take down one of my episodes. I would go from talking to 80 to 90,000 people to talking to 8 or 9 million people in a month. if they did that to me. Every time they get completely unreasonable with who they attack, our movement grows. Every time they do it, our movement grows. More and more people go, huh, really? They did what? Really? They did that? To who? This old lady? Really? Oh, hell no. What if a couple hundred million people said, oh, hell no? I think your government would say, oh, no. What they're going to say is, oh, crap, they know. They know their own power. There's no more solution inside the Beltway, folks. You want to be politically active? Do it at your county level and your state level. And that's still an uphill battle, but at least you might get somewhere. This giant monstrosity of a federal government is turning into a stinking, rotting corpse. And it will do a massive amount of damage to the people of this nation if we're willing to kneel in front of a rotting corpse. How weak must we have become as a people that we will kneel before a dying, rotting corpse in fear that it may no longer shed its benevolent, rotting light upon us? How far from our founding must we have come that we fear being known as someone who will stand up for the very principles our nation was founded on? This is how they win. If you will fear standing up and taking a stand that says you will defend and uphold the very foundational law of your nation, if you will fear being known for that, what will you be bold for? The answer is nothing. The answer is nothing. We'll all be bold for as much as possible. I've won more people over to prepping when they find out I'm public with what I do than anybody has by saying, oh, we got to keep it quiet. There's a place for operational security. But I'll tell you what, I say if times get tougher, even if they don't, times aren't that tough yet. You know what the time is for right now? Boldness. Decisiveness. I dare you needs to be our attitude. I dare you. I dare you to jack with my Constitution one more time. I dare you to take away what I've worked so hard to build. I dare you to attack me. I know you're bigger than me, and I know you're stronger than me, but I also know you're Achilles' heel. You need the vast majority of this nation to either be apathetic or on your side. And I know the harder you fight and the more you attack people like me, the more you wake up the apathetic and the more you swing those who are in consort with you. So go ahead. I dare you. Do it to me and do it to somebody else and do it to somebody else and do it to somebody else. And don't think we'll go away quietly. Don't think we won't fight back. Don't think we won't tell others. Don't think we won't broadcast it. Don't think that we won't YouTube it. Don't think that we won't Facebook it. Don't think that we won't tweet it. Don't think you'll make me fear. Because I won't. I dare you. Don't tell me I can't raise my child the way I want to. I dare you to get between me and my child. Don't tell me I can't raise my child with homeschooling if that's what I choose to do, or private schooling if that's what I choose to do. I dare you to mess with that. Don't tell me I can't worship the way I choose. I dare you to jack with that. Don't tell me I can't not worship if that's what I choose to do. I dare you to jack with that. Don't tell me what I can say and what I can't say. I dare you to mess around with that. You know, we had a political commentary guy on the show last week
that does mainstream radio that talks about a lot of these issues. And quite a few times he said, the America I remember, the America I remember. And a lot of you got out of sorts with him because you're like, what is this America that you remember? Because we've been dealing with this crap for as long as any of us has been alive. A lot of the policies that are in place today that we blame Barack Obama for, some of them began under Ronald Reagan or earlier. They're just more in your face now. So what is this America that you remember? That's what it was, folks. Even when they were incrementally taking this stuff away, at least people had the attitude of, I dare you to jack with me. And now the very people that claim to be the remnant are afraid? We're afraid? What if they do the things that were done in Nazi Germany? They did it because people were afraid. The greatest tyrannies and evils are cast upon men who quake in fear and kneel at the boots of the tyrants who do set abuse to them, to their families, and to their fellow brethren. The greatest victories are won when people stand in the face of tyrants. And both literally and figuratively say, I dare you. I dare you to tread upon me. I got a bunch of emails, folks, right in with this, that top brass in the Navy is now telling Navy SEALs that they must remove the Navy Jack flag, the Don't Tread on Me flag, that they've worn since their inception. You must remove it. Let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. I have a feeling that some in Naval Special Warfare may just turn around to said brass and say, make an issue of this. Put me in a court martial for something that we've worn since we were created. I dare you. How bold will they be? They will be as bold as we allow them to be. How bold will we be? As bold as our hearts and our spirits and our determination allow us to be. And with that, this has been Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
solution is you.